About 1,000 years before Jesus appeared on earth, one of the wealthiest men in the world wrote a book. His journal is quoted by many well-meaning poets as a sentimental favorite. To everything there is a season, turn, turn, turn. But Solomon's diary is actually somewhat dark and, well, cynical. Well, today on Insight for Living, you'll hear Chuck Swindoll introduce a new series on this celebrated Old Testament classic. He's called our study in Ecclesiastes, Living on the Ragged Edge. And as we begin this adventure together, we'll start with a survey of Solomon's book. Chuck titled it, A Journal of a Desperate Journey.
See, one of the reasons we are so boring as people, as Christians, is because we read our immortality message into every single scene. That's also another reason we don't have too many real answers for the real problems. We're too quick with the ultimate answers to feel the horror of the present pain. And this writer says, before he ever mentions obeying God and fearing God and walking with God, he throws his hands up in the air as an executive in his office. And he says, it's nothing. There's nothing here. I have nothing that brings satisfaction. One man writes this, the book clearly states at the outset that it is limiting itself to that which is apparent to the natural mind. One of the key phrases of the book is the continual repetition of the words under the sun. Look at verse 3. What advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? If you get above the sun, you're not going to see through the eyes of this writer. You've got to live under the sun. You've got to see only the human perspective. You've got to pursue only what the human mind can pursue, or you'll throw this book out. You'll say it's a bunch of heresy. You'll say this is fodder for the skeptics, and you're exactly right. They quote it all the time back to us. You see, there your own book says there's nothing new, there's nothing to it, that men and women end up the same way as dogs and beasts of the earth. There's nothing to this thing called godliness or Christianity. Read it in your own book, and they'll quote Ecclesiastes. Still reading from this writer, Ecclesiastes is a collection of what man is able to discern under the sun, the visible world. The book does not take into consideration revelation that comes from beyond man's powers of observation. It is an inspired and accurate book. It guarantees that what it reports of is what people actually believe. But it is an examination of those beliefs. The book is not merely a collection of ancient philosophy, for what it talks about is very much up to date and extremely relevant. Here is what you will hear propounded in soap operas, in political speeches, in the radical and the conservative movements of our day. Here is what you hear in the halls of academia, or on the streets of any city. In this book, the philosophies by which people attempt to live are brought out into consideration and examined. And the results of Ecclesiastes are exactly correct. It is so pointless. Now the question is why? Why is it so meaningless? Why is the treadmill so empty? Look at verse 4. A generation goes and a generation comes. The earth remains. The sun rises and the sun sets, and guess what? Tomorrow morning it's there again. Big deal. The wind blows to the south, the wind blows to the north, the wind continues to swirl around in its circular courses, and the wind returns. The rivers flow into the sea, and the sea is never full. You ever been able to explain that to your kids? I can't either. Can you explain to them why there is an ocean of salt water, and the only thing that feeds it is fresh water? I can't explain it either. The place where the rivers flow, they'll flow there again. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. It's exactly what he says. I don't care how brilliant, I don't care how brainy, I don't care how many letters follow your name, I don't care if you live to be 125, I don't care when you get all through and you look at life strictly under the sun, it's a boring place to be. It's the pits. It's the pits. The eye is never satisfied with seeing. The ear is never filled with hearing. There's always something else to see. There's always something else. You've got to hear this singer. Have you heard her? I mean, she is. And you hear her, you really ought to hear, and you give them the name of somebody. It's never finished. How about seeing sights? You want to go to Europe to see the sights. So you go to Europe, and you're singing Peggy Lee's song. Is this all there is? And you say, well, I probably haven't seen Italy. So you take in Italy. And you want to go right back to some other place where you were. And you go to London, and you go to Paris, and it's empty. You can't wait to get back. And it was the very thing you're getting back to that you wanted to leave only a few weeks earlier. There's nothing out there. So even if you had all the money in the world to do all of the projects in the world, you would wind up saying, verse 9, there's nothing new under the sun. No one can say, see, this is new. It's existed for ages. There's no remembrance of earlier things. Think of the grandfather who has to come to realization of this. Especially if he's pursued some irresponsible itch in his life. Think of his putting his grandson or great-grandson or granddaughter on his knee and looking at her in the eyes and saying, you know, there's nothing that's going to be remembered. There are later things that will occur. There will be no remembrance for them among even those things that are going to yet happen. They're not going to be remembering it. Can you imagine launching a child into a life strictly under the sun? Hey, I got news for you. They do it every day. Every day. It's empty and it's pointless because there's nothing new. There's nothing remembered. There's nothing that counts. It is a monotonous repetition. Life is not worth living, and therefore I am going to search for something that will give it direction. One man calls this kind of life that we try to leave the straight life. Here are his words. The straight life for a homemaker is washing dishes 3 hours a day. It is cleaning sinks and scouring toilets and waxing floors. It is chasing toddlers and mediating fights between preschool siblings. One mother said she had raised 3 tricycle motors and they had all worn her out. The straight life is driving your station wagon to school and back 23 times per week. It is grocery shopping and baking cupcakes for the class Halloween party. The straight life eventually means becoming the parent of an ungrateful teenager, which I assure you is no job for sissies. It's difficult to let your adolescent find himself, especially when you know he isn't even looking. The straight life for the homemaker can be an exhausting experience at times. And how about for the man? For the working man, it's not much simpler. It's pulling your tired frame out of bed early every morning, 5-6 days a week, 50 weeks out of the year. It's earning a 2-week vacation in August and choosing a trip that will please the kids. The straight life is spending your money wisely when you'd rather indulge in a new whatever. It is taking your son bike riding on Saturday when you'd much rather watch the ball game. It's cleaning out the garage on your day off after working 60 hours the prior week. The straight life is coping with head colds and engine tune-ups and crabgrass and income tax forms. It's taking your family to church on Sunday when you've heard every idea the minister has ever had to offer. You thought I'd leave that out, but it's right in there. It's true. It's giving a portion of your income to God's work when you already wonder how ends will meet. The straight life for the ordinary garden variety husband and father is everything I've listed and more, much, much more. Jim Conway calls it the midlife crisis. He says one result of all this pressure is extreme frustration. The man finds himself living by other people's goals and feels angry at them as well as at himself for allowing this to happen. He cannot change now, however. He's too deeply committed. He may feel that everyone is taking from his life. I said to Sally at one point, I feel like a vending machine dispensing products. Someone pushes a button and out comes a sermon. Someone pushes another button for a solution and out comes a personal or administrative answer. The family pushes buttons and out come dollars or time involvement. The community pushes other buttons and out come meetings and I sign petitions and I take stands. It's easy for a man in midlife to feel that he's trapped with obligations to everyone and the frustration is that he cannot get out. In his 20s, however, these demands were handled with enthusiasm. Later, it isn't so much fun. It's a world of tension. It's a world of boredom. It's a world of demands and responsibilities until you want to pull your hair out about age 45 or 50. That's why guys walk around with their shirts unbuttoned down to their belly button. They have a big gold medallion, and they drive a new sports car, and they wear tight breeches, and they talk cool, and they dress and look funny, and their toupee is a little large, and they have to push it around so that they look cool, man. They're into it. And all they're trying to do is to leave the straight life behind. They're up to here with straight life stuff. If there's another demand on my time, I'm going to scream, he thinks, and sometimes does. You talk about a book that's relevant. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. And I think the paraphrase would add, and I'm up to here with being king over all this nation. Probably got mags on his chariot and split that afternoon. Right on out of the street. Frankly, that sounds like a wonderful idea to me right about now. No, he said, I'm not going to do anything silly. I'm gonna put my mind and my money to use, and I'm going to find out what it's about. And you start reading, and you'll find out what it's all about. It's right here in the book, page after page after page. Now, the difference in this journal and every other journal or book or Blue Highway or song is that this one is inspired of God. Count on it. A sinner wrote it, but an absolutely perfect being oversaw the writing, so we have God's word about leaving that kind of life. We have God's promised truth regarding the pursuit of happiness under the sun. God doesn't lie. So what you've got, and if you will be honest enough with yourself and ultimately with this whole series of messages, not to read the back of the book first, you'll feel the full blow of a life lived under the sun, which is the life of your neighbor, it's the life of your prof, it's the life of your friend at school, it's the life of many a professional person, perhaps your own physician. It is the life of the homemaker. It is the life of people apart from God's perspective. There isn't any exaggeration in this book. To exaggerate is to push the truth a little beyond its bounds, and God doesn't do that either. Let me show you something. I set my mind to seek and to explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. I decided if there is some other field out there that is greener on the other side of the fence, I'm going to find it and I'm going to eat it because it's something I'm missing. And he says it's a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. And I think he has in mind his job, his responsibilities. This whole thing that's now fallen into my lap is too much. Maybe you feel like that with your own business or your own profession or your own pursuit. Maybe you finished your schooling and that's back a decade or two ago and you found that plateau that you were looking forward to, and it is not only not that great, it is not even edible. There's not even much green grass around. And furthermore, your colleagues are more disillusioned than you are. Says, I've seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, it's all empty, empty, zilch, zero, striving after wind. It's all set and it can't be changed. What's crooked can't be made straight. What is lacking cannot be counted. It's all lacking something. I'm going to go for it. So chapter 2, he rolls up his sleeves and he goes for it. You talk about hedonism, you've got it in spades when you get to chapter 2. We don't have the time to go through each one of the chapters, but I'll give you a little bit of the taste of this one. After that multiple verse introduction, he says, I said to myself, see, this is where it all starts. I looked myself in the mirror and I realized that I'm not the man I used to be, and I began to see the wrinkles and the gray hair, and I began to realize I'm not getting any younger. And I said to myself, you're getting too serious about life. You got to start enjoying it. So he pursues a life of pleasure. I will test you with pleasure. So, says to himself, enjoy yourself. He tells us before, he even goes to his pursuits. As he's writing his journal, it wasn't worth the effort. I said of laughter,
madness.
I wonder how many comedians, when they're washing off the makeup and the lights are out and they're in their own little cubicle about ready to go back to that lonely hotel room for yet another night of entertainment. Wonder how many of them think, oh my Lord, this life stinks. Ever thought about getting an audience up for another series of dirty jokes and another series of empty stories and only to tell them again another night and another night in front of another bunch of people looking for the laughs? You ever thought about the emptiness of that? It's madness. I decided I would stimulate my body, verse 3, with wine. That's what I need. I need something that you could put in a bottle. I need some booze to take the edge off. And while my mind was guiding me how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there is for the sons of men. Can't you see him? He's on his way. We're talking wild living, wine, women, song. There's got to be something out there that will bring pleasure. In fact, he even goes so far as to try projects. He says in verse 4, I enlarged my works, emphasis on my. I built houses for myself. I tried that. I planted vineyards for myself. There's no satisfaction. I made gardens and parks for myself. I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I could have told him ahead of time, that will not work. I've tried that one too. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. That didn't satisfy. Got stagnant, mosquitoes swarmed in the thing, it was empty. I bought male and female slaves, and I had home-born slaves, and I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. I collected. Here's a collection now. You've been around people that collect? Collected silver, and then I collected gold and the treasures of kings and provinces. Ever been to people's homes where they've collected? And they always have movies of places where they've been, and you're sentenced to a couple of hours of seeing where they've been. And you go in this room, and there are heads that are coming out of the wall, and there are spears, and there are funny-looking things under glass. And I often thought, when there's nobody to show it to, what do they do in that room? They stay out of that room. That's what they do. Because it's boring. Those movies are boring, except for the couple or three that went there. And all those creatures that you shot, that they just collect dust. Because it's all empty. It doesn't satisfy. If you're getting the message, you're getting into it. None of the stuff works. Pleasure carries with it three problems as I think about these early on sections of the book. First of all, it promises more than it can produce. Just planning on it is always more exciting than the thing itself. And if you doubt that, go to eat in a busy restaurant. Looking forward to it is a lot more than scarfing up the grub. Take it from me. Sure as the world, you'll get a table by the window and it'll be cold and the one leg will be shorter and the waitress will be a witch and it'll be a bad experience. Trust me. It promises more. Your hope for it is always greater than the actuality. People who doubt that have never traveled abroad. And once they do, they see what that means. It's funny. You can hardly wait to get back to the very dump you tried to get away from just a few weeks earlier. Second, the satisfaction is only in the act. It's only during the act. That goes for the booze, that goes for the extramarital affair, that goes for the collection, that goes for the purchase of the thing that you've been looking forward to, that goes for the first million or whatever it may be in your dream, or the first billion. In the act of acquisition, that is the maximum. Nothing pleases from there on, it's downhill. The third thing about pleasure is that It results in boredom and or frustration. It's horrible. He says it. He says in verse 10, all that my eyes desired, I didn't refuse them. I didn't withhold my heart from any pleasure. My heart was all, was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. See, in the very act, there was the pleasure. There was the reward. I considered all my activities, which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted, all was the same old cycle. So I decided I wouldn't stop with pleasure. I'd press on. And you know what he discovered? He discovered that life kind of has its cycles. There is sort of a fatalism, sort of a humanism that comes out of the balance of chapter 2 and on into chapter 3. He says in verse 17 even, I hated life. You ever thought that? I think more say yes to that question than no. I hated life. For the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me because everything is futility and striving after wind. Think of the life of the celebrity. Spends his life in a car way back in the back seat and the windows are so dark you can't see inside. He or she pays someone to do the driving, pays someone to do the cooking, pays someone to do the cleaning, pays someone to do the investing, pays someone else to do the guarding, pays someone to take care of all of these things, and he winds up a multimillionaire with no friends. And he's got to sleep at night. And there aren't enough pills made to give you the uppers or downers you need to keep your thing going, especially if you're in a performance routine. And finally, it's handfuls of them. The stories of Johnny Cash, of Elvis Presley, of Howard Hughes can be multiplied ad infinitum, ad nauseam. We talk about boredom, chapter 3, a time to give birth, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to uproot what's planted, a time to kill, time to heal. That's exactly the way it's written to be read. This is not written to go on tombstones. This is not written to be etched into marble on some great statue. This is boredom. Time to tear down, time to build up, time to weep, time to laugh, time to mourn, time to dance, time to throw a stone, time to gather stones. It is boring. It makes you want to puke. And when you're all through with it, he says, what profit is there in the whole messy cycle? None. None.
And thus begins our excursion through Solomon's Journal of a Desperate Journey. You're listening to Insight for Living and the beginning of a new verse-by-verse study through the book of Ecclesiastes with Chuck Swindoll. As Chuck has begun to build Solomon's case that all is vanity, it doesn't sound very hopeful, does it? But all of this churning will crescendo with purpose and meaning, of course, when we get to the latter chapters of Solomon's Journal. You can order all 24 sermons in this classic series by going online to insightworld.org and looking for Living on the Ragged Edge. Sometimes our pursuit of happiness yields lackluster results because we're chasing after the wrong outcome. Happiness, we're learning, is a byproduct, a benefit of walking with God, but not our primary focus. Well, that's one of the reasons Chuck Swindoll hand-selected an excellent book for you to read.
In the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson used the now famous phrase, the pursuit of happiness. Remember that? Happiness was declared an inherent or unalienable right. Those who follow Jesus Christ have been granted an even greater unalienable right. Not happiness, but holiness. So then, what does it really mean to live in holiness? Is that something bestowed upon us from heaven? Or is it something we earn? Can we become more or less holy? And if so, how? Furthermore, what part is God's responsibility and which part is ours? Those are the questions answered in a classic book I would love for you to read. It's written by Jerry Bridges, titled The Pursuit of Holiness. When you truly begin to pursue the standard of God's holiness, your personal perspective on life will be transformed. You will be in awe of God's perfection. And at the same time, you will be grateful for His love and grace and mercy. God is the one who said, "Be holy just as I am holy." Isn't it time to face what His command really means? The Pursuit of Holiness by Jerry Bridges. Get a copy.
Thanks, Chuck. And here's how you can request the book today. It's yours when you include a donation of any amount. If you're listening in the United States, call 1-800-772-8888. Online, go to insight.org. As you likely know, Insight for Living is entirely listener-supported by loyal friends who value Chuck's teaching and want to see these programs continue. When you give, we'll say thank you by providing this excellent book from Jerry Bridges, again, The Pursuit of Holiness. And if you've never contacted Insight for Living, we'd like to give you extra incentive to do so today. Chuck preached a sermon called Encouragement Served Family Style. It's recorded on CD. Just give us a call and let us know you'd like a free copy. The title again is Encouragement Served Family Style. If you're listening in the United States, call 1-800-772-8888. This free CD offer isn't available online, but for all other resources, including the convenient mobile app, go to insight.org. More from Solomon's Journal of a Desperate Journey tomorrow from Chuck Swindoll and Insight for Living.
The preceding message, Journal of a Desperate Journey, was copyrighted in 1983, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2013 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide.